a young perspective on hot-button issues around the world. This is The Hub.
Hello and greetings from China Development Forum at the Diaoyutai State Guest House in Beijing. I'm Wang Guan. Welcome to The Hub on CGTN. Now, this year's China Development Forum saw Chinese Premier Li Qiang addressing the opening ceremony and gathered participants from around the world, policymakers, CEOs from multinational companies, you name it. Now, once again, the Chinese economy is in focus. Is China's economy losing momentum? Is China still a investable place for investors from around the world? Now, on the sidelines of the meetings, we caught up with some participants. Let's take a listen. Jeffrey, you've been coming to China, attending this CDF. What's your takeaway from the keynotes and speeches?
I think the emphasis this year is on the technology. Every CEO is talking about the advances in technology in China, the use of artificial intelligence, the advanced digital infrastructure, the green technologies. So what I'm really feeling is things are on the move for exactly the kind of digital green transformation that the world needs. It's happening in the industrial sector here.
China is trying very hard to reassure global investors and the Chinese consumers. If you look at this recent policy meetings, to let the world know that basically China is still an investable place. How do you think this message is coming across?
I think the message is clear because we're hearing very proper, sophisticated presentations from the premier, from the ministers, and I think these are very convincing. The problem is the United States government badmouths China. So the U.S. goes around the world attacking China, trying to undermine China, trying to tell U.S. businesses, no, no, don't invest there, go to Vietnam, go to this one, go to that one. And China has to respond to that. It doesn't want to respond by having an argument with the United States. It responds in a very mature way, which is we're going about our business. Our economy is doing fine, thank you. We're making advances. We're making innovation. Don't fall into all of this name calling. That's really, I think, part of what's happening.
Yeah, exactly, Jeffrey. If you look at State Department, for example, they listed China as a reconsidered travel country, basically putting China on level 3 alert, only above countries, with all due respect, the brother countries like Afghanistan, Iraq, and Chad. If you're an American citizen looking at this State Department travel warning, I assume that you will be reluctant to go.
Unfortunately, the State Department became an arm of propaganda rather than a conveyor of factual information. Traveling to China is about the safest place in the whole world, also one of the most fascinating places to come in the whole world. The idea that there are travel warnings against that from the U.S. is part of this kind of propaganda that makes no sense at all. I just wish the U.S. government would be honest, mature, and respectful in its relations, because everybody would benefit if the rhetoric went down, if the truth were at the forefront, we would have absolutely normal relations together of the U.S. and China.
Professor Sachs, I want to get your sense of the Chinese economy and where it is right now. We talked to the IMF Director General, Managing Director, Madame Gorgieva, and she thinks that the temporary slowdown of the Chinese economy is a transition that most emerging economy countries will have to go through, from high rates to high quality. From a long historical point of view, where do you think the Chinese economy is right now and where it is heading?
China continues to be a fast-growing economy. It has a high saving rate. It has excellent education. It has a high rate of innovation. The problems right now are U.S.-imposed problems. The U.S. basically said to China, you're not exporting more to us. We're not going to invest more in you. You're not getting these technologies. So the U.S. is trying to put sticks in the spokes, as we say, of China, slow down the Chinese economy. How obnoxious, by the way, that one government is saying, oh, we want you to have worse economic performances, if it's any business of the United States at all to take that view. That's really the main headwind that China faces. All the other things that are talked about, the real estate market, yeah, there's something there, the local government debt, but not anything huge and significant. I wish the IMF would acknowledge China's problem is the U.S. policies. high tariff rates against WTO, technology bans that absolutely are inappropriate, warnings to U.S. companies, stay away from China, de-risk, friendshore, onshore. This is what is happening. Now, I don't think that this will derail China's growth. The U.S. imposes sanctions on countries that don't have all that much effect. Just look at the U.S. pounding Russia, and the Russian economy continues along the way. So there's a big exaggeration in the U.S. mind of what it's actually accomplishing. And when it comes to these barriers on high-tech exports to China, say of the advanced NVIDIA chips or others, my feeling is China's going to innovate around this pretty quickly. Whether it's 6 months or a year or 2 years, I'm not so worried because China's filled with top world-class engineers and capacity. But the U.S. is trying to put this headwind in front of the Chinese economy. My feeling for China is China is the world leader in so many technologies now, electric vehicles, batteries, photovoltaics, wind turbines, long-distance power transmission, 5G. The whole world needs this stuff. If the United States is closing its market, the rest of the world is keeping its market open. That's where China's going to continue to have a lot of growth. I want to see China expand programs like the Belt and Road Initiative, which strengthen the links between the Chinese economy and these other economies in a win-win proposition.
You're talking about America's technological sanctions against China. TikTok is in focus again. Its CEO, I believe, recently said that they will not sell TikTok to an American company, which is exactly what the U.S. Congress asked TikTok's parent company, ByteDance, to do. You divest of TikTok, otherwise you're going to be banned in the United States within 180 days. How do you feel about that?
Well, first, the whole attack on TikTok is totally wrong-headed and misguided and a kind of American paranoia. You can't have TikTok in the U.S. market.
That's going to
threaten U.S. security. This is nonsense. So this is the first point. The second point is that there are other forces that say, well, part of the problem on TikTok is it's an open platform and we're hearing things that American politicians don't want the American public to hear. It's said that that's true about the conflict in Gaza, for example. And so they're trying to control the media in the U.S., the U.S. politicians, in a way that the public doesn't want. I don't think they'll succeed in the end, but I've been through lots of these phases of fear-mongering in the U.S., even during my lifetime, these different phases. And to my mind, this is just another one of these occasions. I think it's completely misguided.
Do you think this phase of fear-mongering might pass? We talked to Steve Orleans, and he said basically China-U.S. relations could be bottoming out. Where do you think China-U.S. relations is?
If the American politicians were honest and knowledgeable, and if more scholars said to the American politicians, just calm down, behave, China's not a threat, ease up. We could, of course, have a bottoming out and a turn to improvement. Unfortunately, the American political class outcompetes each other for saying things that make no sense. And especially in election year, things are likely to be very even ugly rhetoric, like the TikTok, because each party is outcompeting. Oh, I'm more against China than you are. No, I'm more against China. This dynamic leads to ridiculous approaches and policies. And unfortunately, both of the leading candidates right now, both Trump and Biden, have an anti-China record. So I'm just feeling not very happy about our political situation in the U.S.
And finally, on the Chinese economy, what would be your advice on China's transition, you know, into a digitally empowered, green industry empowered economy? What would be the challenges and how should policymakers take note of these challenges?
Well, my main advice is really go for it. The world needs a zero carbon energy system of the future. What does that mean? It means zero carbon power generation. It means wind, solar, fourth generation nuclear. It means electric vehicles. It means battery supply chains. It means hydrogen economy. It means digital efficiency. China's got all of that. So I'm saying go for that. And then China is the platform to help the whole world make this transformation. It's a growth strategy for China and absolutely good for the world to have China be making all of these innovations. So I'm very, very keen and enthusiastic that no matter what the U.S. might be saying right now, China should really accelerate this digital green transformation internally and through programs like the Belt and Road Initiative.
Jeffrey, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Let's talk about COP28.
We see the geopolitical poles kind of shifting in this direction.
Last December, I met Ben Harburg on the sideline of COP28 in Dubai, the United Arab Emirates. And months later, he's here in Beijing at the China Development Forum. As a member of the board of directors of the National Committee of U.S.-China Relations, what's his takeaway from the forum and where does he see China-U.S. relations heading? Let's take a listen.
Ben, welcome back to China. I want to start by getting your sense on Premier Li Qiang's speech yesterday. What are your major takeaways?
Well, I think it was, you know, what we've heard before, but it solidifies those narratives that are kind of being countered in a lot of the Western media, which are that China remains the world's largest consumer market, the world's largest manufacturing market, that it's an inextricable piece of the global supply chain, and just the importance of the Chinese economy going forward and the damage that decoupling and other forms of subjugation might affect it.
You've been attending CDF for a number of years. What's different this year?
It's a very different feeling than last year. A much larger American and Western business presence, much more public. Last year, for instance, Tim Cook was very quiet and kind of came in the back door and snuck out after a short meeting. This year, giving a very prominent speech and speaking about sustainability. It feels like there's less shame from the West in terms of participation in this conference and maybe more of a harder push from the Chinese side to get those Western participants. So.
As an investor and observer of China policies, what is your sense of the China market? Where is it right now? How are you positioning the China market going forward?
It's been a really challenging few years. It's been challenging to attract capital to China. It's been challenging to get global investors to feel confident about investing here, particularly when the U.S. stock market is flying. It's also been hard to convince folks that the Chinese economy is healthy like it used to be, that Chinese consumers are going to participate in the market like they used to. There's fears because of the devaluation of assets on the public markets, real estate. So it's really been a time of cleansing for us to think about bottoming out the market, looking at the fundamentals here, again, the size of the consumer base, the size of the manufacturing base, and then looking at these as lows that then can be built upon for really strong returns going forward.
There are so many theories going around. One says the China model is running out of steam, China is peaking. Do you look at it that way?
No, I don't. I think, you know, there's so much green field for China still to grow. Manufacturing could get hugely more efficient and, of course, more sustainable. As a consumption-led market and one domestically led, Chinese consumers are still just coming to their own. There's a huge consumer base still to be brought online as we urbanize China and bring up more rural populations into the major cities. And the numbers that I hear from my colleagues that are running international businesses here in China are phenomenally strong. So, for instance, I was talking to a friend who runs Disney in China, and they said they've been sold out for the last 100 days for their parks in Shanghai, even in the midst of winter. And so just these kind of anecdotal stories around the consumer demand here show that there's still very healthy buying going on.
Yeah, also, Ben, tell us a bit about your peers and your colleagues that you've been talking to. I see you catching up with some friends, multinational company representatives here in China. What is their sense by talking to them about the China market and about being in China, investing in China?
Even last year, during some of the kind of more negative periods, a lot of them were still quietly doubling down on the Chinese market, doubling down on their manufacturing capability, doubling down on their investments here. And I think that that now is continuing to accelerate. We're hearing really strong narratives around China consumption. China, you know, from a manufacturing base, still is unmatched. You heard Tim Cook yesterday saying again that for them to be a sustainable business and for them to continue to improve their supply chain, they have nowhere else to look but here. And so I think that that gives folks a lot of confidence because China really is the global leader when it comes to that fourth industrial revolution, robotics, EVs, solar, all of those core components need Chinese supply chain and manufacturing.
Talking about China-U.S. relations, Steve Orlins, his sense is that U.S.-China relations is stabilizing somewhat. And in all likelihood, it could be bottoming out. What is your sense of where China-U.S. relations is?
I think it's going to be a continued war of attrition. So you're just going to continually see volleys from Washington around specifically targeted actions, particularly against Chinese business or political interests to maintain American incumbencies, be they political or economic. I don't see things necessarily improving, and we're going into obviously an election year where things could actually get worse. The outcome of the election will be interesting, because if there's a Trump administration, we could see a more binary outcome when it comes to China. If it's Biden, then we're going to see kind of more of this continued attrition.
Are you going to meet the Chinese leadership this time around without spoiling some protocol?
We'll certainly try to see some of the high-level folks and get a sense directly from them, their sentiments around the market, what the actions they'll be taking to support global businesses in the private sector here. It's critical for us to understand that.
China announced a series of measures, including unilaterally waiving visa requirements for more than a dozen European countries and some in Asia Pacific to reassure foreign investors, tourists, students. Are they working? What would be your advice for the policymakers?
There's certainly China's open for business. There's no doubt about that. My only fear is that a little too late. A lot of that trust that was broken over the last 4 years is going to be a bit harder to mend. And really, though, what overcomes all of those trust issues when it comes to the China economy is performance. If the Hong Kong stock market is performing the way that it is, China A shares the way that it is, and NASDAQ and the NSP are flying, it's going to make it a very hard sell. And so China, I think, focus should be more on improving the economy, improving support for the private sector. It sounds like we're not going to get a stimulus, but other measures that could give and drive consumption in the market, give consumers a feeling of confidence to buy more, as that improves share prices, that will draw people back to the market.
Mm. New quality productive forces have been a buzzword in recent Chinese policy meetings. What is your understanding of it, and how do you see that playing a role in China's economy?
So I think that China, being a smart manufacturing lead, one that's highly automated, one that utilizes AI and other kind of core technology inputs to continuously improve its efficiency, is a key component of the Chinese economy. And I think China's already doing an incredible job on that front. But there's obviously still further room for growth, and that's clearly a policy focus of the government.
Ben, thank you so much.
Now, in light of multiple challenges, how will China work out its own solutions? Earlier, I also spoke to Professor Cheng Li from the University of Hong Kong and heard his readings on China's economic landscape.
What do you think are the most prominent features of this Chinese path to modernization?
You see, the previously Chinese leader talk about socialism with Chinese characteristics. Also, there are several different variations. These are still valid, but now the emphasis on the modernization, which China wants to be part of the modern world, want to be part of the international system, probably even contribute in significant way. But it's also with the Chinese style, not the Western style modernization, but the Chinese style, but it will be part of the global world, not against the modern, not against the global, but also take advantage of China's own strength, contribute that the new wave of globalization, new wave of modernization. One of the things is that the clean energy, environment development. The second is emphasize e-commerce. And the third is not only to put emphasis on poverty elimination. China certainly scored very, very well, but also to help more people to enter the middle class, the rank, the so-called common prosperity, eventually will stimulate the three engines of China's economic growth, which is investment, consumption, and foreign trade. At the moment, all these three areas faces some challenges. This is the result of structural change. I think that if China continue to put emphasize, particularly promote the private sector to let more people join that middle class rank, eventually will tell the world China is the largest market, China is an opportunity to resolve the problem, not the problem itself.
Yeah, Dr. Li, over the past few months, a theory is gaining traction in the Western world that is China peak. Do you agree with that assessment?
Of course, I do not agree. I mean, the whole thing is completely wrong. You look at the statistic, China has the $18 trillion US dollars economy. It's based on a nominal term, but if it's by PPP, it will be $35 trillion. China is ranked number 2 economy in terms of GDP, of course, also go back to PPP will be the first. The growth rate is still pretty good. Last year it's 5.2%. And also you see the rise of a middle class. The GDP per capita also grow very, very strongly. Now, I want to share with you that the so-called China peak, it's not the first time, many times, and especially, for example, 1989. I remember, this is the first time I returned to China after I came to U.S. to study in 1985. Yeah. The airplane was almost empty. This is early 1990. I went to Tsinghua University to study rise of the Chinese engineers, particularly in the leadership, which we call technocrats. And so that's the things that when I observed, I thought that the Chinese leadership probably will increasingly recruit for this pool, engineers and natural scientists and et cetera. Certainly, I was right. I think China's best day is yet to come. International travel is still relatively low, but domestic travel already returned to normalcy. I mean, the Bay Area, I can tell you during the Spring Festival, about 2.5 million people both ways went from mainland, visit Hong Kong and Macau, and also about 2.5 million visit Hong Kong people visit the mainland. So it's a fascinating development. So now the Bay Area is booming, and every weekend, there's almost 500,000 Hong Kong people go to Shenzhen to spend the weekend over there, somewhere 300,000 people to 500,000 every week. Think about that tremendous potential for the country. So this is the things I wanted to mention. I do not want to mention about the technological development, the emphasis on innovation, e-commerce, and also new energy. These are all great opportunities for China's next phase of development.
Yeah, Dr. Li, talking about technology and AI in particular, what role do you see AI playing in the future of Chinese society and the Chinese economy?
Everything. We knew that the AI era will come, but very few people, maybe none of us, can recognize that it will come so quickly, so penetratingly. And it's changed everything. You look at the scale of the change, the speed of change, and the relying on skilled workers. These are all revolutionary. We are in the early stage of AI era. Now, the interesting thing is Chinese government and put a lot of emphasis. Probably China is among the, some of the governments to have the AI strategy map or work plan. And also Chinese, very interesting, Chinese not just simply emphasize technology, but also put the technology as a part of innovation and also start to issue many regulations and norm and rules and even I think we should emphasize on ethics. So I think that also to repeat the obvious, that the Chinese government also call for international cooperation in various areas, including war and peace. The interesting thing is that in San Francisco meeting, I think a potential landmark agreement is between President Xi and President Biden talk about the continuation of human control of use of nuclear weapon in the era of AI, because otherwise it will be a terrible, terrible, devastating situation. So I think I'm glad that two AI great powers form a consensus on this area. We probably will see more information about that agreement in the months to come.
Dr. Li, there are challenges, though, facing the Chinese economy. If you look at the fact that tens of trillions of RMB's worth of savings have been added to Chinese households, while household consumption remains less than robust. And also for foreign companies, according to AmChamp and British Chamber and European Chamber, not a whole lot are leaving China, but they're not reinvesting as much or as expected. So what policy signals do you think from the Chinese government can send to its domestic consumers, investors, as well as global investors, to really ensure that China is perceived as still a promising market to invest in?
I think it's a very, very important question. Now, of course, that the previous two-digit growth is over, and the previous model of economic development also largely over. China cannot be driven by property development, and the stock market, the IPO list will profoundly change in terms of global economy. And the Chinese leaders is right. China should be concerned about the risk in the financial sector. That's actually explained. Chinese leaders want to have the financial reform, and then wanted to emphasize our financial risk vulnerability. If you look at the previous meetings in the past couple of years, maybe even earlier, 6-7 years ago, President Xi Jinping already emphasized the need to deal with the risk that China confronts. Financial risk is one of the top. Now, of course, the Chinese economy faces a series of challenges. Private sector needs to really have the new input. Of course, Chinese leaders are aware of that. Some people blame that the policy are kind of overemphasis on the security, but I think the reason is complicated. On one hand, not China, the all countries emphasize security in today's world. Without security, how could you develop? But there's some other reasons. One is a structural change of Chinese economy. The so-called the new normal now become a reality. Second is global economic slowdown. And also the so-called China past the peak and also overemphasis the risk of Taiwan Strait. These all play around in a way that the people very much concerned about China's economy. If government wanted to fix that problem, they still have some stimulus plans can apply. I actually favor this kind of stimulus plan. If the stimulus plan still does not work, you know, this will tell us it's multiple reasons involved. They want to make sure that when you use, definitely effective. At the moment, the cost for this stimulus plan probably is still a concern we need to figure out, China needs to figure out. So I think it's a comprehensive package, emphasize innovation, emphasize big consumption, middle-income development, and also continue to promote foreign trade. But the important thing is that you uplift confidence only through the economic recovery. Otherwise, that you only delay that process. So I'm in favor of economic stimulus plan. I also believe that Chinese leadership have a lot of new policy can be implemented.
Dr. Li, thank you so much for your insights.
That will do it for this edition of The Hub on CGTN. Thank you so much for tuning in. I'm Wang Guan in Beijing. I'll see you again soon.